Wednesday, February 6, 2008, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3633. And we have a number of people who are signed up here, and we're going to take it in the order suggested by Attorney General Hardy Myers, who we're pleased to have back with us today. I'd like to call up first a panel of Steve Dole, John Stein, and Meg Garvin. Mr. Dole, are you leading off?
I am.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole, and I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3633 in its current form. I want to start out, I'm going to try to make my comments as brief as possible in keeping with the spirit of this session short. But I do want to start out by thanking some people, and I want to start out by thanking this committee and the legislature for passing HGR 49 and 50 in the last session, which creates the foundation for what we're here to talk about today. This was a watershed in the crime victims movement to finally take the bar off of the, to remove the bar from the crime victims' constitutional rights and allow victims to appeal when their rights were violated in Oregon. Because as you know, rights are completely illusory without that, without being able to appeal when your rights are violated. I want to thank Attorney General Myers for his leadership and his foresight in creating, now building on the foundation and creating this framework that we're talking about here today in order to set the rules and enable these constitutional amendments when they're passed. Because without this, we would not have any order in the system. Without this, we'd have sandlot football. We need rules. We need order. One thing, that when we came to the table on this, we asked for two things. We asked for directness and expediency, and I think we got that. I also want to thank all the members that were drawn together and worked together in the work group. We had a lot of divergent views. We had a lot of people that came to the table with different agendas, but I think we all pulled together, and I sat there at any given point. There were only two or three of us that were not lawyers at the table. And I, without being too flip, I got a new respect for the famous or infamous line, is what is the meaning of what depends upon what is, because we would literally sit there and fight over one or two words, but I respect that, and I have a new respect for that. I have two people here with me today. That one is a graduate of law school. He always says, "I'm not a lawyer." The other is a trained lawyer. But what's really important about all three of us here is we're all crime victims advocates. We all advocate for crime victims. As you, I know you see me here in the Capitol, and you know that I advocate on a political level. But when I'm not here, and sometimes even when I am here, and I've worked with many of you, with your constituents, on victims' issues when they have problems within the system. And that's what I'm doing when I'm not here. But I've seen the travesty of what happens when rights are violated. I've seen what happens when a victim is told that they can't speak, that they can't come inside the courtroom. I've seen what happens when a victim is told that there is a plea agreement made, and then that plea agreement is broken. And it's just a re-victimization, is what it is, short and sweet. 3633 will allow victims to act in a pro se manner if they need to, or with counsel. It will allow victims to be informed on how to act and when to act. And as I said, set out the rules to enable the system to work. It will reduce litigation around how and when these matters take place. It's the first time in the country that we've had a crime victim's bill of rights that has the framework built around it in order to make it work. So I would say this, I've got people with me here today that can speak to this much better than I can, but this will put an end to people like myself having to be the bearer of bad news and look in crime victims' eyes and say, you have a right, but there's nothing that we can do about it when it's broken. And with that, I would turn it over to my friend and colleague, John Stein.
Thank you, Steve. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm John Stein. I'm the Executive Secretary for Policy and Administration at the International Organization for Victim Assistance, which is something of an offshoot of the National Organization for Victim Assistance, where I served as a public policy dude in Washington, D.C. for 25 years or so. My comments, my thoughts are drawing on my decades of work and a career that I'm proud of. I got wonderful tributes this past year from the World Society of Victimology, the National Crime Victims Law Institute, and the Congressional Victim Rights Caucus. But I have found that my fulfilling work is not yet fulfilled. It's continuing, and this is, I've been terribly proud to be part of this process. I want to register my disagreement with Chancellor Otto von Bismarck. In this instance, he was wrong. The famous line, there are two things you don't want to see watch being made, sausage and legislation. I watched this bill being put together, and it was an extraordinary experience for me, a layman, as Steve indicated. I was in the company of some very, very smart people who worked very intensively over words, phrases. They brought in a world of experience in the criminal justice system, and the process itself was extraordinary. We were disparate people from different kinds of interest groups, and over the years I've seen a lot of grief from, let's say, the defense bar, the civil liberties bar. Those representatives and from the judiciary and the district attorneys and on through the whole process worked absolutely harmoniously. My belief is that we shared two common ideas going into this process. And I have those ideas right at hand here. Okay. Everyone wanted to make it very difficult to hide violations of victim rights. There are so many procedures put in place in the proposed legislation to make sure at every step that everyone is playing by the rules. Secondly, the other goal was to make it very easy for the victims who are aggrieved for failure to honor their rights to get justice in the end and quickly. For all that, I will say that what you see is, I don't have it here, you've probably seen a chart of how the appeals process goes, as we proposed here. It takes on two pages. There are branches going everywhere. It looks extremely complicated, and in fact, there are complications plenty in the bill. But underneath that cloak of a legal verbiage is something extraordinarily simple. As Steve said, all of us try to figure out ways to make it easy for victims on their own to raise a complaint and have it heard and have it resolved. And, you know, for us, if you pinpoint any one place in the whole system where something went wrong, if you go to that place in the legislation, you'll see very clearly what the next step is supposed to be. That, when it boils down to that, it's very easy. Now, what the job that is, will remain if the legislature supports us in this legislation, a job that will remain on us victim advocates is to write the user's guide, to make it simple for victims and their advocates to make use of this. In this, it is absolutely parallel to the a project that Attorney General Myers has ably brought forward, which is a compliance project. It is an administrative way to get problems addressed and solved. It is particularly well suited to get endemic problems in a justice system. There's nothing we can do in this bill, for example, to correct a police department, and I won't mention any big city police departments in our state, that fail to get their officers to hand out the victim rights card, which the law requires. But one complaint through the administrative system would go to the chief, and the problem would be solved very quickly. And that's the joy of that system. This one, of course, gets to the complaints when the victim is farther along in the process and something goes wrong, this system will come into play. They're parallel, they're complementary, and they're both designed to be consumer-oriented, user-friendly. They're wonderful. In fact, I go to Toronto in 5 or 6 weeks to a roundtable convened by the Ministry of Justice of Ontario on how they can improve their system of responding to victims. They're victim-friendly. They're victim-oriented. They think they can do better, and I think they're right. I want to tell you, this is the best bill, the best set of victim rights procedures in the country today. All 50 states have victims' bills of rights. This will be the best, the most thorough, the most thoughtful, the most user-friendly. But I will very proudly present both the compliance idea and the enforcement idea that has been developed by the Attorney General's office to them as being models that they want to try to apply to their Canadian experience. I'd say finally that I just want to share with you what I've shared with my colleagues in this work group. Hardy Myers is just an absolutely wonderful leader. He brought out consensus. Occasionally, for some difficult people, he imposed consensus, and those of us who have been imposed on are proud to have acceded to his good judgment. I'm just delighted to have been working under his leadership. So, with that, thank you.
Ms. Garvin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of the National Crime Victim Law Institute in support of HB 3633. As way of background, I am an attorney. I am the director of programs at the National Crime Victim Law Institute in Portland, Oregon. NCVLI provides technical assistance to attorneys and victims and advocates around the country on the enforcement of victims' rights under their respective state systems as well as the federal system. NCVLI also submits amicus curiae briefs to courts, state and federal, around the country. My job as director of programs is to oversee all of those efforts, including education on enforcement. I have testified in front of the United States Congress on the state of the nation of victims' rights, as well as working with the United States Congress on the 2004 Federal Crime Victims' Rights Act. And prior to joining NCVLI, I clerked for a federal judge in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. Just 1 year ago, this legislature embarked on a journey to convert the rights in the Oregon Constitution that at that time were mere rhetorical pats on the head, really, to crime victims into enforceable, meaningful rights that had weight and meaning in the system. That journey led to passage of HJRs 49 and 50. Referral of those to the people of Oregon was of great moment in this state and of great moment around the country. Because it marked a turning point in the advancement of victims' rights, a focus on the idea of enforcement in a very particular way to amend a constitution. The legislative journey certainly could have ended at that point, and what would have happened is that victims, prosecutors, defendants, defense counsel, and the courts would have all been left to try to figure out what that constitutional change meant, and they would have had to muddle through. Fortunately, we live in a state where Attorney General Myers had the foresight to do what no other state has done, which is plan for and map out the procedures to implement those constitutional changes. So the bill you have before you is landmark legislation. It is not landmark legislation because it creates new rights for crime victims. Those rights exist in the Constitution. It's landmark because it provides a roadmap to everyone in the criminal justice system, prosecutors, defendants, defense counsel, victims, and judges, about how to, all the how-tos of assertion, enforcement, and challenge of assertion and enforcement of rights, and also the way to seek appellate review when there is a denial or a disagreement about what a right means. So the question becomes, why is providing a roadmap so landmark? Why don't we let folks muddle through and figure this out? Well, it's landmark for three reasons as we look across the country and compare what Oregon's doing to other states. First, while 33 states have constitutional amendments that provide victims with substantive rights in the criminal justice system, the majority of those states, and in fact almost all the states, have just a patchwork of statutes and rules that govern the procedural implementation. What you have before you would be the first comprehensive set of procedures for implementation of a constitutional victims' rights amendment. The work group that developed this legislation under the guidance of Attorney General Myers did so very carefully and thoughtfully. Discussion of any assertion or enforcement of a victim's right inevitably led to discussion of what impact that assertion would have on other participants' rights and interests. All countervailing rights and interests were put on the table, discussed thoroughly, and what you have before you represents an agreement on how best to ensure that the constitutional rights of all Oregon citizens are afforded to them and enforced in the criminal justice system. There was careful consideration of giving weight and meaning to each right, victims' rights, defendants' rights, as well as the obligations and interests of the state and the judiciary as we proceeded. And the outcome was affording rights without impermissibly infringing on other rights. For instance, the bill provides a clear mechanism by which a victim can assert a violation of his or her constitutional right in the trial court. It immediately thereafter provides the mechanism by which a defendant or prosecutor can counter that assertion and present evidence to the court. Just as importantly, it then follows and provides guidance to the court on how to receive that information, how to process it, how to review it, and the standards by which to decide the outcome of that claim. And perhaps most importantly, it then sets forth a clear process for how to get rapid appellate review of the outcome of that trial court's decision. It's a holistic approach to implementation, which would be a first in the country. Second, providing a roadmap avoids confusion amongst the participants regarding how, when, and where. Avoiding confusion has the benefit of avoiding unnecessary litigation. For example, in states where there are constitutional rights for victims but no statutes or rule governing the procedures for implementation, frequently we have seen litigation on technical matters, such as whether a victim has standing to file a particular piece of paper and the name on that piece of paper regarding assertion of their rights. Such litigation over the proper procedural device delays determination of the substantive meaning of the right. That delay hurts the individual victim by potentially completely denying their rights due to mootness. It can hurt the defendant by impeding the speedy resolution of the charges against him or her. It hurts the state's ability to prosecute because it may divert resources, and it ultimately hurts victims in other states by leaving them in the dark. In contrast to what's going on in other states, this proposed legislation avoids each of these systemic dysfunctions by setting forth in detail how to proceed at each step and will avoid the unnecessary litigation of what is the proper procedural mechanism to use. Finally, while today Oregon is among those few states that have unenforceable constitutional rights, with anticipated adoption of the constitutional amendments in May, Oregon will take its place among the majority of states that allow for enforcement. This proposed legislation will take Oregon beyond merely being among those states and will place it in a leading position. It's true because what is in front of you presents clearly defined trial and appellate court practices that will allow for expedited judicial review. This expedited judicial review will weed out claims of constitutional right that lack merit even at the trial level, but will allow meritorious claims to be heard by the trial court as well as the appellate courts of this state, and will allow for proper resolution of those by the courts, who are supposed to be and are in fact the final arbiters of constitutional rights. The processes established will allow for court opinions to issue that will clarify the scope and meaning of rights for the victim and the defendant and all players in the present case, but perhaps most importantly also for those future cases so that we won't have to have the same issue arise again. In sum, victims' rights are constitutional rights, and they are civil rights. And pursuant to very clear longstanding American jurisprudence, they should be afforded meaning through presentation and consideration of the courts with participation of those persons most interested in those rights, the victims. To date, that hasn't happened in Oregon, and we've had illusory rights. Over the last year, substantial steps have been taken to change that, and the pending constitutional amendments will partially right the wrong that has been done, but this bill will finish righting the wrong because it will provide the clear processes to effectuate assertion and enforcement, so we'll have guidance. Both the victims, the defendants, the state, and the courts will have guidance and will be able to proceed to resolve the most significant of controversies that hinge on constitutional rights. So this legislation will serve crime victims, but also will serve the criminal justice system and the general jurisprudence in the state on constitutional rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Garvin. Mr. Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for your comments. It really gives me certainly a new appreciation for this piece, especially when you've all termed it, I believe, landmark legislation, and due credit to Attorney General Myers. Mr. Dole, you had mentioned that you support this bill in its current form, and I'm curious because I seem to recall, was it just yesterday? Seems like a month ago already, that Attorney General Myers indicated there were some Dash 1 amendments that were coming in regard to Section 1 and then Section 6 that had something to do with early definition of facial invalidity of claim and perhaps other areas. So are you not supporting the Dash 1 amendments, or are they not coming?
No, we are in support of the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to invite Brad Berry, Yamhill County District Attorney, forward.
Good morning, Chairman Joseph McPherson and members of the committee. I am Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney. I, too, chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. However, candidly, I will tell you that this bill has not been reviewed by them. I'll talk a little bit more in a minute about how I have vetted this bill to my elected colleagues. I am confident, I'll say up front, though, that ODAA will endorse this bill completely. And again, I'll mention that more in a moment. I served as the lone prosecutor on Attorney General Myers' work group to develop this legislation, although certainly I was in good company with those seeking to assure victims' rights, by especially those who were just speaking with you. You've heard a great deal about the process for crafting this bill. It involved many, many hours and change after change to accomplish a consensus on both procedures and remedies for victims. I, too, need to compliment Attorney General Myers and Deputy Attorney General Pete Shepard and their ability to develop consensus among a diverse group of professionals. The end product is a lengthy bill that appears more complicated than it really is. Throughout the discussions, I continue to reinforce that any adopted process should be user-friendly and should be user-friendly for what would usually be an unrepresented victim. Each member of the work group embraced that theory, and we worked time after time in changes and recommendations to see that, in fact, we had a bill that would come that way. Mr. Stein mentioned that this bill, upon the passage of HJR 49 and 50, will preemptively establish a uniform practice throughout the state for addressing the rights of victims and for a process where victims may address the court if they feel they have not been afforded full extent of those rights. Without such legislation, each county would be left to devise its own system to address a complaint by a victim. Not only would this be inefficient, but it would be difficult to ensure a process that is understandable to victims throughout the state or to ensure a prompt process at the trial and appellate level to address such a complaint. As I mentioned, as I opened, ODAA has not officially endorsed this, and in part that's because it's gone through many, many changes, as I mentioned, and I think, as Representative Flores mentioned, Dash 1 amendments haven't even been printed yet, although we recognize what those will include. Having said that, though, I do want to point out that the Oregon District Attorneys Association did, and if I recall correctly, did so unanimously, endorse the concept of enforceable victims' rights embodied in HJR 49 and 50. And again, with that, I'm confident that they will support this legislation. However, it is important to note a couple of things. Oregon's prosecutors have been a champion for the rights of victims. Do we get it right every time? Of course we don't. However, victims look to us for information about a case, information on how they can be involved, and explanations of what and when things are happening throughout a case. In some cases, victims agree with the end result proposed by the state. In some cases, they do not. But in all cases, they have a voice. This legislation ensures that their voice will be heard. Although I do not have a specific position from ODAA, I have circulated versions of this bill to my elected colleagues. Most have responded with some questions about it. None have been negative towards the process that's been set forth. However, I would be remiss if I did not address one significant issue. That is the issue of workload. As you can see from this proposal, much of the responsibility for notice to victims and ensuring meaningful involvement in the system falls on the shoulders of the district attorney offices throughout the state. This workload will increase related to hearings that may be held when a victim wishes to have an issue addressed. We all have victim advocates. Most of our staff dealing with victims is funded at some level by federal VOCA grant monies. These funds have been reduced in the past, and the VOCA folks at the federal level have announced within the last week that we can expect a 20 to 30% reduction in the federal budget for these funds over in next year. This, of course, will translate to fewer dollars coming to the counties and fewer advocates to perform this important work. Any fiscal impact developed for this legislation will ignore the cost to individual counties and the district attorney offices with the primary responsibility to carry out duties imposed by this significant legislation. I ask you to be mindful of that and consider financial assistance to the counties to deal with the loss of federal funds and the increase in workload. This can be done by additional monies awarded to the Attorney General's Crime Victims Assistance Services Office to ultimately be dispersed to the counties. Having said that, House Bill 3633 is the product of hours and hours of work by many involved in the criminal justice system to ensure that a victim knows their rights and their role in the system and to ensure their meaningful participation. Let us not forget that most everyone in the criminal justice system is there by choice. Police, district attorneys, defense counsel, and judges have chosen a career that daily involves them in the criminal justice system. Even a defendant, by his actions, chooses to be involved in the system. Only a victim is involuntarily dragged into the criminal justice system. Let's have a system that acknowledges that fact and sees that the victim's role is not only guaranteed, but meaningful. Again, thank you for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Berry, any questions? Representative Shields. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Berry, do we have any sense of how much extra dollars might be involved in funding this extra workload?
Chair McPherson, Representative Shields, I could tell you for my office. I think that Cynthia Stinson from the Attorney General's Office and Crime Victims Assistance would be able to put a value to what that potential cut would be statewide. All I'm suggesting is we consider keeping it whole. We all recognize we're going to have a lot more work related to this as we adopt best practices from the Compliance Rights Project as well as this legislation. I'm not necessarily advocating we need to grow our offices, but we ought to be able to stay stable as we begin to assume this additional work. But I'm confident that Cynthia could come up with that figure for you.
Thank you very much.
Taylor. Mr. Bradbury, I take it it's not really the bill that's causing the fiscal impact, but the constitutional amendments if they're adopted. I mean, this is really a roadmap implementing those provisions, is it not?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Mr. Taylor, the answer is sort of. These rights have been in place for a long time. District attorney's offices, I think, have endeavored, some with greater success than others, in seeing that victims are notified of their rights and keeping them enforced. HGR 49 and 50 create a system whereby they become enforceable, and this bill creates a process whereby enforcement can occur at the trial court and appellate level. However, at the same time, it reinforces that district attorney offices have all of these duties, which some of which we've known before, some of which we are aware of now, for notice, for example, of every hearing, for advising the court whether or not a victim wishes to make a statement. Some we've done before, some we've not done as well before. So I think it is the overall development from both the compliance project, HGR 49 and 50, and this bill that will create the additional workload for DA offices.
One further question, Mr. Chairman.
Robert, my assumption is if we didn't have this bill, these issues would be determined by the courts on a case-by-case basis through litigation.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Mr. Taylor, yes. What actually would happen is a victim in Multnomah County would be set to guess how they go about raising their rights, at least alleging that the right has been violated and getting that remedied, and a victim in Yamhill County would have a different process, one in Deschutes County would have a different process. And you would have no set process that was predictable, and any place that a victim could go to say, how do I bring this issue before the court? That's what this bill does.
Thank you.
Ms. Berry, the rights attached to a person who's identified as a victim as defined in the constitutional amendment, and that requires notice from the prosecutor to the individual as a victim, which will be obvious in many instances, but maybe at the margin not so obvious in some. And so I wonder if you have any observations about the burden on, if it is a burden, on the prosecutors to identify properly who those victims are in order to create the rights that attach in the first instance.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, a victim in generic terms is defined as someone who had injury, has a financial or psychological impact as a result of a crime. Typically, you're absolutely right. We know who the victim is. They're alleged in the charging instrument for the most part. Ann Christian and I were just discussing this morning, Ann Christian from OCDLA and I were discussing this morning about, you know, what if you have a mother of a victim? Are they in fact a victim? And they may well be in certain circumstances. It is not uncommon that our offices become aware of those who have an interest in the case that in the broader definition of victim may include them. And I think most of us will, I'll speak for myself now, my office would err on the side of providing notices to more people than less people if they feel that they are a victim. The issue may come at some point, though, if they don't fall within the definition of a victim and they attempt to assert a right in the court at some point may need to make a decision that, well, you're technically not a victim who has an enforceable right in this proceeding. And so ultimately that decision would probably be made by the court. We may take a position as they come to us and say we want X, Y, and Z as a victim, that they don't actually qualify as a victim. But again, in most instances where you're talking, giving information, keeping people apprised of the proceedings, it's one of those, why not? Somebody else has an interest, just provide them with the information.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Berry, you mentioned a cut in federal funding. How significant is that? Are you losing entire staff, or is it more of a small cut? I just want to get a sense of the magnitude of that.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, members of the committee, we've been told it'll be over a 20% cut coming from federal funds. Again, speaking for my office, my victim's assistance office consists of a director and four employees. All, except for my director, all four of the other members of my office are paid for by entirely or in part by grant monies. Two of those positions are VOCA funded, one at about 30 to 40% and one almost 100% by VOCA funds. If I lose 20%, I mean, you can just figure out that's about what it would be. I think it'll be a little more than 20% because they also have talked about other things the feds will be doing VOCA money that will not allow it to filter down to the states. So if they have the 20%+ loss in actual designated funds that are VOCA funds, there are other things they're doing besides sending monies to the state, which will take an increased portion of what is funded.
Thank
at
you.
That level.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Berry. We appreciate it. I'd like to invite up now a panel of Circuit Court Judge Eric Block, Nancy Cosine, and Jim Ness.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Cosine. I'm the Criminal Law Staff Counsel at the Oregon Judicial Department. I would like to start this morning by offering a thank you to Attorney General Myers for including the Oregon Judicial Department during the discussions of the HJR 49 and 50 work group. The Judicial Department was asked to participate in the work group with the goal of creating a court process that would ensure crime victims the ability to participate in criminal proceedings. I had the privilege of participating in those meetings, and I can offer a brief explanation of the Judicial Department's role during those meetings. As you know, under current law, crime victims are not able to enforce the rights that are granted under Sections 42 and 43 of the Oregon Constitution. The Oregon Judicial Department's primary focus during the work group meetings was to ensure that each section of the proposed legislation could be incorporated into the court's current practices and procedures in the least costly and most effective way. To that end, the department did at times point out policy issues that had an operational impact on the court system. And we made clear the avenue of least impact, but ultimately left the policy decisions up to the work group. While the work group did not always choose to adopt the least cost policy option, it is safe to say that HB 3633, with the -1 amendments, is structured in a way in which each section does fit within Oregon court's current practices and procedures, thereby decreasing some of the potential costs associated with this legislation. The Judicial Department does expect that this legislation will have an indeterminate but substantial fiscal impact, but it will also offer a very clear avenue for victims to enforce and assert their crime victims' rights, which were incorporated in Sections 42 and 43 of the Constitution back in 1999. The Chief Justice, the Oregon Judicial Department, and Oregon courts are committed to ensuring that all people affected by the criminal justice process are able to participate in that process, including victims. And this legislation will allow that to happen. Judge Block will be able to tell you a little bit more about how this legislation will impact Oregon's judges and the trial court process. He comes to us from Multnomah County, our largest court. And I have with me Jim Ness, the appellate court counsel, who can tell you a bit more about how it will impact the appellate court system. I'm available for further questions if you have them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Cosine. Let's go on and hear from Judge Block.
Right. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to address you. I really don't have much by way of prepared remarks, just a few jottings and notes. My role here today is similar to the role that I played, and it was a fairly abbreviated role on the work group, and that was to attend certain meetings for the purpose of providing information to the work group as to what procedures in the circuit court currently are and how the procedures that are proposed in HB 3633 might function well or otherwise, and the extent of impacts. Let me indicate at the outset again that I found the operation and functioning of the work group to be truly remarkable. Prior to taking the bench in various other capacities, I had the opportunity to work on a number of different committees and groups, drafting legislation, policy positions, and I thought that under the leadership of the Attorney General and his deputy, that this work group in particular brought together persons holding disparate and firmly held beliefs, but that there was engendered a very strong spirit of goodwill and professionalism that did allow for the sharing of perspectives, the understanding of various perspectives, and I think that that is borne out by the product that you see in this bill. As a circuit court judge, and I have had the privilege of serving as a circuit court judge in Multnomah County for the past 5 years, virtually every day I oversee sentencings, I oversee the taking of pleas, and probation violation hearings. All of these proceedings under 3633 are designated as critical proceedings that will, by statute, involve the participation of crime victims. Under the current functioning of the courts, as a circuit court judge working with partners, primarily the DAs, and others in the criminal justice system, we seek to recognize the rights of crime victims and allow those crime victims to have those rights effectuated in our proceedings, be they rights of participation, which at the very least often provides the crime victims with the important value of closure, feeling that they've had an opportunity to be heard, and often very often provides me as the decision maker with valuable information that allows me to make a better decision. So we try every day to see that these rights that currently exist are effectuated. I would associate myself with the observation of District Attorney Berry, and that is we're not perfect. Sometimes we, despite our best efforts, we overlook something. But I do not believe that that is anything close to the vast majority of experiences. But if, as I believe, House Bill 3633 will reduce the instances where crime victims are denied their rights of participation and other rights afforded them under the Oregon Constitution, then I think there is certainly value to that. I also think there is value to this bill because it does provide a clear guidance and structure to how, on the circuit court level, as well as the appellate court level, which Mr. Nass will address, but how these rights are to be effectuated. The rights of participation, which begins, of course, with the district attorney informing the court who the victims are, and through that information, then the court is empowered to become a partner in seeing that these participatory rights are effectuated. So there's the structure provided to how the rights of participation will go forward, and then where there is a grievance, an allegation by a victim that the rights have not been honored, how is that dispute to be adjudicated on the trial court level? And there's very clear guidance and structure given to that adjudication process. And before this bill, in the absence of this bill, those disputes were resolved on an ad hoc basis with ad hoc procedures. And so to the extent that this provides greater clarity and structure, and it does, I think there's certainly value there. We need to recognize that this will come at some cost. There will be costs, dollar costs. There will be costs in terms of efficiency, which is a term that one can define in various ways. But clearly, there will be delays and other losses of efficiency that come through this process. There are conflicts, to be sure, that can and will be adjudicated. There are conflicts that arise between a victim's right to participate by being present in a court versus the right to have witnesses excluded, and where the victim may be a witness, that's a real conflict that a judge is going to have to adjudicate and make a decision regarding. There are conflicts regarding a defendant's right, if in custody, to have their trial heard within 60 days versus delays that might be engendered while the trial court and then the appellate courts determine exactly what the rights are of the victim and whether those rights have been aggrieved. There are potential conflicts arising from a criminal defendant's right to have a probation violation heard within 14 days if they're in custody. And then, of course, there are potentially conflicts between victims' rights and speedy trial rights that exist under the Oregon and federal constitution. So there are potential conflicts. Of course, we're not unaccustomed to dealing with conflicts in the courts. In fact, that's the raison d'etre for us being there, to provide a means by which these conflicts can be addressed. So with that, I'll end my comments and, of course, be available to respond to any questions. Thank you.
Senator Krieger.
Judge, could you address the issue of security in the courtroom? We're going to be mixing more defendants and victims together. You're going to need separating them, or you're going to need more sheriffs in there. You're going to need more security when these people come into the buildings. I know in some of the rural counties, the other day I just walked into a circuit court in Gold Beach. I didn't walk through anything. Just walked through the door and sat down.
Right. And Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, I don't bill myself as a security expert. My attitude is that we do have experts, certainly in my county courthouse, the Multnomah County Sheriff and his deputies, in my judgment, do an outstanding job in securing our building and affording a safe workplace, as well as a place for members of the public to come and do their business. I have to believe that there will be some issues around that. I can't speak to them with any more precision, but I can tell you this, just from my own perspective, there have been occasions where the victim is present in the courtroom and the defendant is brought in, and the atmosphere in that room changes immediately. And I remember one occasion fairly recently where it was a young man who was the defendant, who was there for domestic violence assault, and I was very thankful that we had adequate security in the courtroom. So there may be some issue there, to be sure.
One follow-up.
Go ahead.
Is there any process, Judge, that you're aware of where, like the counties that don't have security always in the courtroom on minor things, where the security people, the sheriff, would be notified, hey, we have a sensitive issue because of the crime? Would the courts be then maybe requesting more time of the sheriff to come in?
I think I consider it to be at least part of my responsibility to understand as best I can whether, by virtue of the presence of the victim and the nature of the crime, there are going to be heightened security issues. Sometimes just the very nature of the crime gives the sheriff a heads up. Certainly when we have murder trials, particularly involving gangs, there is a heightened level of security. I think that is an issue that we're going to have to be mindful of as we go into this process, be sensitive to, and over time, hopefully, we will establish some sort of a working understanding or relationship where if the DA is aware of that information, that they're, I mean, this is more than your normal average victim-defendant relationship. If there's a lot more there, then I think that's important for the for anyone knowledgeable of that information to bring it up, so that then we can be in touch with the security agency.
Any further questions? Judge Block, the bill has some fairly tight timelines, including, I believe, a 7-day response for after an allegation of a violation of a victim's right has been lodged. Any particular reaction to the timelines in the bill? Are we is that going to be a cost driver to have these tight timelines, or that would tend to get the things disposed of promptly and promote judicial economy? What's your thinking?
Well, Chair McPherson, I haven't quite thought of it in terms of its cost impact, whether a tighter time frame is going to be more costly than a more relaxed time frame. I think, frankly, you could make arguments either way. What I will say is that these time frames are aggressive. I don't say that to suggest that they're inappropriately so. I think we're trying to balance the need to have the issue addressed in a time frame that allows for a remedy for the crime victim to still exist at the end of the day. And if the adjudication takes too long, the more the case proceeds, the more limited is the available remedy at the end of the day. I think we try and deal with that a little bit with the flexibility built in to perhaps suspend some of the proceedings. But there was a thought to have these tight time frames. Again, it is going to have an impact. That the time frame issue is one that is sure to impact the current operation and functioning of the system. And let me just make one point clear. On the circuit court level, counties operate in dramatically different ways and in ways that will impact exactly how this bill can be integrated. And in some counties, it may be easier than in other counties. And that certainly is true for the time frames.
And it's probably inappropriate for me to focus just on the cost aspect, but I was trying to get at maybe a larger point, which is that whenever we legislate that the attention of the court shall be focused within a certain limited timeline on a certain resolving a certain matter, we buy... Naturally, we are affecting the flow of all other business that is coming before the court. And so I guess that's the question I'd like you to respond to is, requiring this prompt turnaround seriously disrupt the other justice that your court meets out?
Chair McPherson, I think it will have an impact. I'm hoping... that it won't have a serious impact. The impacts will vary by county. I'm not trying to evade the question. I guess the bottom line is that time will tell. I think the bill, as I understand it, offers the prospect of avoiding those impacts. I think it's going to take some time to work its way into the current practice, but it may well be that that there are unanticipated impacts and costs associated with it that will only be identified once we have the process up and running.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your Honor, perhaps another way to tackle that question or for ask it from my perspective, I thought I understood you to say that you did not sense that this abrogation of victims' rights was a huge problem. There may be instances where that is the case. So from your position, I understood you say you didn't see that there would be a huge influx of potential claims.
And Chair McPherson and Representative Flores, I think that's a helpful reminder and perspective that, and I hold to that observation, that initial observation, that I don't think there are a large number of instances under current practice where victims' rights are being aggrieved and left unaddressed. So hopefully that will continue to be the case, and this will simply provide us a structure for adjudicating those hopefully continuingly rare instances where there are problems.
Thank you.
No. There are no further questions than Mr. Nass. Or Ms. Kozine, did you have more you wanted to say?
I just wanted to, if I may, Chair, offer one other piece of information, and that is that that with Representative Flores, with that question, the unknown piece for us, and that is hard to determine, is that the court system contemplated here incorporates violations that could be done by entities outside of the court system. So it could be a district attorney, it could be a law enforcement officer, it could be a defense attorney, it could be a defense attorney investigator. We haven't had the mechanisms in place to track those types of violation allegations, so it's very difficult to assign a potential number of claims that could be brought to the court's attention. And we do have the benefit of some other states that have had violation allegation procedures in place. And we understand that some of the other states that have trial court processes in place have seen, as I understand it, probably between 25 and 50 a year. And I could be wrong. Ms. Garvin has more detailed knowledge than I do on that. But we are anticipating that time will have to tell to a certain degree because we don't have the information available to us within the state of Oregon to make that type of determination. Thank you.
Mr. Nass.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the Oregon Appellate Courts. I'm here today to speak only to the appellate review parts of this bill. As Ms. Garvin said, that was an important feature of this bill, and I was pleased that Attorney General Myers invited us to participate and work through those potential remedies. For those of you familiar with the Supreme Court's mandamus jurisdiction, the mechanism for appellate review of claimed violations of victims' rights that will lead to a circuit court ruling are somewhat similar to that, in that the notice of interlocutory appeal will go to the Supreme Court rather than the intermediate appellate court. Also, the appellant will be responsible for including with the notice copies of all the relevant parts of the record. We will rely on the audio record rather than insisting on having a transcript done, because often it's the process of getting a transcript done that can take time. But the appellant, and in most cases we anticipate that will be the victim, often perhaps not represented by counsel, will have a heavy burden because the time frame that's in the bill is 7 days from the date of this of the circuit court ruling to file this to file the paperwork. The court then has an obligation to take the case. Mandamus jurisdiction under the Oregon Constitution is discretionary. The court can choose to take the case or not. This bill differs in that at least in felony and person Class A misdemeanor cases, the court must take that case. The bill imposes a 21-day time limit on the court to decide the case. For those of you who are familiar with judicial review of land use cases, know that you have imposed time limits on those cases for the courts to decide those cases, but you've also empowered the court if it makes certain findings that the case is unusually complicated can extend that time. And the work group agreed to include a provision in this bill. So we anticipate that in most instances the court will be deciding these cases rapidly within 21 days, but there may be an occasional case that's very, very complicated and raises an issue that everybody needs to have decided, that the court would need to give itself a little bit longer. I will tell you that our willingness to agree to these tight time frames are predicated on our assumption that there will only be about 5 to 10 such cases in a year. But we are fairly comfortable that's a good number because of the experience of other states and the Federal Ninth Circuit that have similar legislation. And also it's dependent upon what I think is a key part of this bill is that the processes at the trial court are so clearly defined and give all key parties an opportunity to be heard. So I think that I just think that most circuit court judges and DAs will work hard to make this thing work. And so it will not be often that a victim or the district attorney or the defendant or someone else who was ordered to do something will feel a need to appeal. I probably should mention that in non-person Class A misdemeanor and Class B and C misdemeanor cases, there is a discretionary review process that could give the court a little more time so that if an issue arises in one of those cases that is similar to an issue that arises in one of the more serious cases, the court may have the time that it needs to decide those important issues in a thoughtful way. And I commend the work group for being willing to work with us to distinguish between those two types of cases so that we can work through what we hope will be rare legal issues. And then as time goes on, as these legal issues are decided, our thinking is that probably most of these will merely be enforcement actions where something has gone wrong, there's a need for immediate corrective action, and the court will be able to do that. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them.
Mr. Nass, I'm going to ask I think you've probably responded to it, but let me just put it a little more directly to the same question I asked Judge Block, which is that pressing this work forward will necessarily affect other things coming before the court, and does the Judicial Department have a view on the desirability of accelerating this class of claim and its impact on, or you're comfortable with its impact on the remaining workload?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is a concern because every time you move one case to the top of the line, that necessarily means that a case that's been there before yours will have to wait a little bit longer. As you know from the recent events where there was a challenge to the holding of this session, both the trial court and the Supreme Court moved very rapidly to make sure that those issues were decided in a timely way. And so that, I think, in my view, illustrates that the court, on a rare occasion, is able to do that. It would be tough to do that every month, every week. It would be, you know, that's why I'm saying that there's a limit on the number of these cases, 5 to 10 a year. We could probably handle that. If this was an every day or every week event, we might be back here next session proposing something different. Yes, there is a cost, but the Chief Justice is committed, if the people of the state of Oregon choose to adopt HJR 4950, to carry out the wishes of the people and to have a meaningful mechanism to implement the enforcement mechanisms of these measures.
And this bill has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and we haven't seen as yet any fiscal information. Have you folks from the Judicial Department been, I assume you've been in the process of providing information to Legislative Fiscal and generating the numbers that will be part of that report? I'm sorry, maybe.
Chair McPherson, our fiscal is due at 5 o'clock this afternoon.
I see.
So we are busily assessing, and we're trying to assess the amount of time that each potential claim could take, both at the trial court level and at the appellate court level, and try to, as best we can from the numbers we have from other states, assess the potential number of cases. So we do hope to have something more firm by the end of the day.
Well, what I would invite from you, and it may be that you need to go through that process and complete it, is that if there are policy choices reflected in the bill that's before us, we as the policy committee, we could, if there are things that we're doing that are inadvertently triggering more cost, that will drive the results of that fiscal analysis, then those are things that we would welcome bringing back to us to find out whether there are adjustments that can be made that would affect the outcome.
Thank you.
Any further questions? And thank you very much. I appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong, did you want to come since we're not at the end of our time? And
yeah, it won't take long anyway. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, the juvenile departments in each of Oregon's 36 counties, just here to endorse a minor amendment that we are told are going to be in the dash ones. Of course, we haven't seen those yet, but what we are told are going to be in there is under Section 1, the addition of juvenile departments in the group under the Attorney General's office that will be involved in promulgating the model rules. And so I'm just here to request that respectfully of this committee and that we do endorse that minor change.
And while you're up there, although you may not be the best one to respond, Mr. Armstrong, the Dash 1 amendments have been much referred to. Could somebody tell us what the status of the Dash 1 amendments is and when we'll be
seeing? I'd have to defer to others on that, Mr. Chair. I don't know. I think Mr. Shepherd stepped out.
Mr. Meyer, I don't know if you have that information. I just was curious about just when we would likely to see those.
Chair McPherson, members, I believe that Mr. Nasby in the Legislative Council's office is close to having completed the drafting of these Dash 1 amendments. I'd have to defer, however, to that office to give you an absolutely accurate report.
I just want to get a sense about where we were in the process.
Sorry, for the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Any questions for Mr. Armstrong?
Thank you,
Mr. Armstrong. Is there anyone else here who wants to present on in the public hearing on House Bill 3633? Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3633.
Chair, Ann Christian.
I'm sorry, Ms. Christian, I will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3633.
For the record, my name is Ann Christian. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We have been a part of the Attorney General's work group on this bill. And I would request, since we continue to our organization review and make suggestions for amendments, that we be allowed to provide our public testimony when the amendments are provided.
And that's fine, Ms. Christian. I would we have a pretty tight timelines here in this session, as you know, and no later than next Tuesday have to complete our work on this bill. And it would be my aim, and this is going to be useful to the committee to know this, to move this bill no later than next Monday.
I understand that.
Yeah, so if we could have that timeline in mind, that would be very helpful to our work.
Absolutely.
Very good. Okay. If there are no further questions and no one else to present on House Bill 3633, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3633. That concludes the... I'm going to meet again tomorrow. We won't have any amendments tomorrow. Before I adjourn the meeting, we have posted a public hearing on this bill for tomorrow. Unless there's something to present to us that's further input, we will not actually hold that hearing. So stay in touch, those of you who are following the work on this bill, because we may not actually be meeting because there won't be anything to present to us. Depends on what's coming forward. Okay. Well, then I will adjourn the meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Wednesday, February the 6th.